Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 135. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, penis puppetry. Simon Morley and Friendy are the comedy duo better known as Puppetry of the Penis. They've been performing their penis art for more than 20 years. They've toured the world, sold out large venues, and now they are training other actors to do the show to franchise it out so they can perform in multiple places at once. I got them to talk about franchising a show, touring, why having no plan is actually a great strategy, and how not to care about awards and reviewers. I got loads out of this. I found it really fascinating. It was the right time in the run at Adelaide for me to actually have this conversation with them, and it really sort of grounded me and centered me, and I found it very interesting. We did it in the garden of their flat in Adelaide, and as a result, there is a little bit of background noise and wind issue at points. I have done a fair amount of editing on this to eliminate a lot of it, but there is still minor clacking, like clacking, but I can't really do much about all of it, unfortunately. So it's all audible, but I just wanted to make clear that I am aware that it is not perfect, but it is as close as I'm going to get it. I hope you're not all going mad, and I hope you're all staying indoors. I am stuck indoors, and I am just basically editing podcasts and creating extra content. If you want more content from me, you can find my other podcast, Simon Kane Quarantine. It's on iTunes, or at least it should be by the time you get this, Spotify, and you should be able to just find it by searching Simon Kane Quarantine Podcast. It's a little bit of chatter from me about the news and about what it's like being stuck indoors and trying not to go insane. Arguably, we are all doing that, and it's just nice to feel not alone. So if you'd like to listen to that, there should be a link in the show notes as well if you can't be fucked with Google. Also, this is currently my only source of income, which is very, very depressing. So if you have enjoyed this podcast up to this point, or you are enjoying this podcast and you've not donated, or you have donated and you want to do it again, I would really appreciate any and all donations. You can do it as a one-off via PayPal, or you can do it on Patreon from $1 an episode. For that, you will get ad-free episodes, and you will also get them ahead of time. That's the thing I was going to say, and then I went to say something else. Any and all donations would be massively appreciated. If you don't have any money, do not sweat it. I understand we are all struggling at the moment, but equally, if you can donate, I would be really appreciative of that. Oh my god, I've been indoors too long. If you're new here, please don't forget to hit that subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook. Obviously, I'll be doing a lot of Skype interviews with people in the next couple of weeks, and if you would like to get your questions asked to the industry leaders, even though the industry they work in is currently non-existent, you can do that via the Facebook group. But for now, this is Puppetry of the Penis.
So basically, Puppetry of the Penis for me started as a party trick that I used to do with my brothers. Word got out that we had this special skill, and we found ourselves getting invited to parties where we didn't know anyone. And I knew there was some way we could document these and maybe monetize dick tricks, but without putting our faces out there. I come from a very Catholic family, and it would have killed my mother if I'd gone out there and proudly uh, started getting my penis out for everyone to see. So we thought a calendar was a perfect way to do this without putting our faces out there. Unfortunately, the calendar turned out to be a terrible idea. No one wants penis on their wall every day of the year. So the irony was I did the calendar so I wouldn't have to do a live show, but now I was in a situation where I needed to do a live show to sell the calendars.
Right.
Mm. I'd been doing dick tricks at uni for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years before I met Simon. We actually met each other in Byron Bay. We invented some tricks that day, and then we didn't see each other for quite some time. And when Simon was putting out the press release, the calendar, one of my friends rang me up because I'd done a show for a radio station with a balaclava on because I was working for Norwich Investments at the time. So that's where I came from. And I think Simon was at, you were actually working in the bar at that point, at the bar that I actually did the show at, and he thought someone had come along and stolen his idea. But actually it was me who we'd met 5 years earlier.
Is there a, I mean, or was there a, was that like a thing back then? Were lots of other people doing dick tricks? Because I assume now you could probably type into the internet dick tricks and you would have found each other a lot quicker. So I'm wondering whether that was just that was a uni thing back then.
It's not uncommon for Australian men to kick off their pants and entertain their friends after a couple of drinks.
I think.
I mean, these things were born out of male sporting change rooms. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you'll find most of the Australian cricket team.
Really, Finn? Come on, buddy.
Like you said, someone starts doing maintenance exactly. The minute we start.
Basically, I think you'll find most of the Australian cricket team and the rugby team, they're all very capable of doing hamburgers. So
I tried.
I think you did have to go.
I almost got it sorted. Yeah, well, I'm a grower.
Practice makes perfect.
So, you know, had to,
oh, you got to be careful.
Yeah.
You got to be able to bend it.
Yeah. That's our only motto. We never work hard.
That's right.
But you've got to... I mean, I think this could only have come from Australia. One is there being a suitable climate. You know, this wouldn't have started in England.
No.
The one thing you don't want to do is get your penis out and entertain your friends when it's freezing cold.
No.
You know, I think just the time was ripe. I'm not saying we were the only ones doing this, but we certainly took it way too far and took it to the people.
We did a tour of Australia in 1998, and we would turn up at some towns and there would be a guy come, you know, tap us on the shoulder afterwards and go, "Oh, I've got one you haven't done you know what I mean? And he'd show us what they've got, show us their tricks that they've been doing around their footy club or their cricket club or whatever.
So was your original audience kind of laddie, or did it kind of, because I've noticed that recently you're doing like bachelorette stuff in Vegas,
right?
So obviously that's a completely different market, and I'm wondering how that sort of evolved from A to Z.
Well, in Australia it definitely started, it was very much secret men's business, and we're taking it out to the people. But then the girls started to get curious about what we were doing. And of course, you know, I mean, when we take this show to England, it gets a little Chippendale-ish.
Mm.
And we don't get any men, but I think here in Australia and certainly in parts of Europe and even Canada, men are a lot more comfortable watching, you know, this sort of behaviour.
Mm. Not sure, behaviour.
Yeah, it's behaviour.
Yeah.
It might be bad behaviour, but it's behaviour.
So when you first did a show, like I assume it was you're watching together to see how it works. Was it a case of, I mean, how long was the first show? Did you have an hour's worth of them, or
no? I think we went about 25 minutes.
Yeah, we didn't go very long at all. We had a list. We basically just wrote down all the tricks and we tried to group them together, and then we tried to introduce them a bit like a setup to a gag, and then the punchline is the trick.
Yeah,
and that. When we first started, we didn't really have very good introductions, and that just developed over time. So, and we were pretty nervous. So we rushed through that first one, but the people were really cacking themselves. So we knew we were onto something.
Yeah, definitely. And how long did you? I mean, how quickly did you get a following then? I mean, was it just sort of trying it in your hometown and seeing how it worked? I mean, did
moved management... pretty quickly. And we had some people on Australian radio that got right behind us and thought it was hilarious. So there was a lot of talk about it, And so when we finally hit the road with it, there was, you know, there was a lot of expectation and people were very curious to see it. I mean, it actually makes great radio because you can't see anything and you can just hear people laughing up and you're hearing someone talking about he's made a pelican out of his genitals and the images that congers up is wonderful. So, yeah, I think that worked well for us.
Do you think it could start now? I mean, with the way that sensibility's changed?
I don't reckon. It's really, really changed. I mean, it's 22 years ago that we started.
Yeah.
And things have become very conservative, you know. The kids these days are happy to Snapchat their penis or their vagina and send it out, but they're not happy to get nude necessarily, or they find nudity, you know, disgusting or whatever, you know what I mean? It's like it's a very different generation that we're dealing with right now.
Well, you just look at the university campuses, because when we first started, we were being booked to play all these universities. You know, it was a perfect show for them. But now there's no way you'd get a booking on campus. There'd be protesters.
Yeah. Well, I heard there was in New Zealand, didn't you get?
Oh, we've had protesters.
We've had a lot of protests. Everywhere. But, you know, they're usually a couple of, you know, religious quacks out there with their signage. And, you know, we don't mind them. If anything, they sell us tickets. So
there was a whole town that bound us in Australia for quite some time. Bundaberg. North Queensland,
which ironically make the rum that made us start doing these.
That's right. We were drinking the rum that came from that town when we invented some of the tricks. But then they had a very, very conservative mayor who wouldn't allow, because their only theatre was council owned, and he wouldn't let us perform there. And that happened, and that's happened in the UK. It's happened in the US.
Most of middle America we still haven't been allowed to go to.
Yeah, because there's a lot of conservative people own the theatres over there.
Mm. Yeah, I find the way, I mean, particularly in England, there's a lot of, they say it's not censoring, but in reality I feel like it's more censoring than they think it is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, the other problem for us is, it used to be 20 years ago when we started this, you would go into a local town, you'd run an ad in their local newspaper, and that would reach everyone. Now with social media, we're not allowed to advertise on any social media. They don't want our money. They've got us marked as a sex show, as an adult show, which is, you know, it's just not right. But we get caught up in this loophole. You know, and 20 years ago, like when we got to England, we were featuring on The Big Breakfast. Mm. You know, it was the number one rating show in England at that time. We did The Tonight Show in the US. We did The Footy Show and a few other things here. But now we really struggle. You know, people just don't even want to say the anatomically correct word penis.
Yeah. I personally don't Snapchat and I have no interest in that platform.
Right.
But I know what people are using it for. And really,
what is it?
Well, it's mainly penis shots, apparently.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It's the one where, boobs and it's mainly where if you want to send it, but you don't want it to exist anymore after they've seen it, is that platform.
But it does exist. It's on a hard drive somewhere.
Exactly. And you'd think if your dick pics would be more favoured because they're more interesting than just badly lit.
That's why the hens night started up, because girls didn't want to necessarily see strippers and have that sexy stuff going on where they could laugh at the male genitals rather than have it all sexy and be uncomfortable in that situation.
Definitely. And I suppose, like you said, I mean, social media is such a really important marketing tool now.
Yeah.
If you can't use it, are people allowed to upload photos and text? I mean, you know, surely that would get them in trouble, and then would that get you in trouble? Like, is that causing
it won't
you
get
problem?
Us in trouble, but I've had our Facebook and our Instagram shut down on many occasions, and I'm sure we're teetering on the edge now. You know, they might actually finish us once and for all, which would be rather disastrous for us. So yeah, we very much rely on the people that come to the shows to share it out. I mean, we've always been a big water cooler show, and by that I mean, you know, back when we first started, you can imagine everyone at work the next day on their break standing around a water cooler going, you would not believe the show I saw last night.
Yeah.
And that, you know, anyone, we thought anyone that came to see our show would whether they liked it or not, tell 10 other people about it. It's just therapy that you've got to get through.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping that we've still got that appeal and, you know, that's still getting the word out there, because whereas we're extremely well branded around the world in over 38 countries and we have been going for like over 20 years, there's a whole new generation or several generations that have no idea of our existence. You know, we've got to get the word out there.
Well, let's start from the beginning then. So you've both discovered each other, so to speak, and you've
too much of each other.
Well, I mean, there was nothing left by the end.
One big night in Byron Bay.
Exactly. And you've decided to work together. I mean, there was a period where you didn't talk to each other, but then you got back in touch.
Yeah.
And you decided to work together there and then. Was it?
Yes.
Yeah, I know. I'm just ignoring it now. Before we started, we said, you know what's going to happen? There's going to be maintenance works and people doing construction the minute we start. And lo and behold.
Life in the city.
Life in the middle of Adelaide. So was it there and then you thought, well, hang on, if you've got a trick and I've got a trick, this might be a show.
Well, Simon had the calendar, right?
Yeah.
So then he had to advertise the show, which was going to be run in the Melbourne Comedy Festival in April 1998.
I actually I was hoping my little brother was going to do the show with me, and he was going to do the show. But then about a week beforehand, he got news that he had a recurring role in Neighbours. Okay. And he figured that much like, you know, Russell Crowe or Kylie Minogue, doing a little dick show would ruin his soon-to-be reputable theatre and acting career. So he bailed out, and then luckily, Friendy saw that that I was planning on doing a show and jumped on, and that was it. That's where we were born.
Okay, and like you said, the first show was about 20, 25 minutes.
Yeah. The second show, and it was hilarious. Yeah, the first one went about half an hour, and it was big laughs all the way through. But we did have a lot of family and friends in that first show. The second show was still quite a good audience, but it was drawn out. It was, you know, it was a bit longer. It was about 40 minutes, but it was terrible.
Right.
people weren't laughing. And then we thought, okay, this isn't as easy as what we thought. We're going to have to put some work into this. So then we started coming up with jokes and, you know, structuring the show in a smarter way.
So was your intention for it to be a comedy show from the off, or was it meant to be sort of a trick show? Like what was your thinking behind it with those shows?
I'd done quite a few shows. And I'd done
in comedy or
I'd done shows, just dick trick shows at uni in front of a lot of people. So I knew the reactions it would get.
Yep.
Simon had done it for his mates who were a lot of comedians and stuff. So and he knew you get comedians laughing, that's a pretty hard task.
Yeah.
So we knew the reactions that we got early days, people would laugh uncontrollably. They would lose their shit. So we knew there was something there. It just had to be, as we say, it just had to be polished up a bit, didn't it?
It could have gone one or two ways. I mean, it could have been, for the rest of our days, we could have been unemployable and those guys that did that weird little dick show. Or if we crafted it properly, and I also was very aware of the fact, because I'd been overseas, I'd been to Edinburgh, and I knew that if you've got a show like this, that's very visual and it can cross language barriers, this could be a huge bonus. So it was either going to one or two ways. It was going to go gangbusters, or it was just going to pretty much ruin our lives. So that was up to us.
Yeah.
And you know, luckily we made it go the other way.
You went balls in.
Well, yep. We did that tour, and by the end of that tour we had a pretty decent show.
Yeah.
We had good hour show.
Mm-hmm.
Had, you know, we'd
good reviews. Is it getting reviews good by that point?
Not so really much. We got a couple of good reviews for the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Right.
Not so much when we took it around Australia.
When we went to Sydney, we got some pretty good write-ups in Sydney when we went to Harold Park Hotel.
Yeah.
We really smashed it there.
Because I'm wondering what was causing word of mouth, whether it was the nature of it. To sell the show, I imagine, it's just you can get a one-line pitch quite easily.
Yeah.
And that you know, then you know, the advantage of that is it turns on the people that want to, so to speak, turns on the people that want to come and see it, and turns off the people that are like, no, it's not for me.
Right.
Which is what you want from a show, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in Melbourne, we had a girl come and review us for the biggest newspaper, The Age, there.
Yeah.
And her quote was, it might be too early
to
name a best outright show of the festival, but Puppetry with the Penis, you know, might. So she was alluding to the fact that early in the festival, so we just took that outright best show of the festival.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we ran with that.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah,
we also had the number one national radio drive show right behind us as well. So wherever we went in Australia in that tour, they were expecting us.
Yeah.
They'd already heard of us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that it wasn't like we had to go ahead and have the newspaper articles with the quotes and the reviews, because 2-3 times a week we're getting a mention on this massive radio show.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And who was, I mean, I assume you didn't have any press or PR person by this point. It was just the two of you. Yeah. So how were you getting this kind of coverage? Were you just emailing in? What was the process?
I was a comedy promoter, so I was already working with some of the best comedians in the country. Mm. People like Jamoan and whatever. I'd been touring with for years. So we knew pretty much everyone that was on the television and the radio.
Right.
So then it was just pretty much pulling in some favours.
Definitely. Mm. It's sort of like a gamekeeper gone poacher or whatever, you know, that sort of changing side. Yeah. So did you always want to become a performer and it just happened that you were doing promotions?
Not really. I've always seen myself more of as a producer. And, you know, I probably, you know, might have got someone else to do the show if there was anyone else to do the show. But, I it was more of a necessity to jump the fence rather than a choice.
Right. So,
but once I did, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. So, do you have an agent then, or are you the agent?
No.
As well?
We have people. Sorry. We have people around the world that we work through, you know. Yeah. But we pretty much look after ourselves.
Yeah. How did you meet, or at what point did you meet people that were starting to? Well, first of all, who was the first person to believe in your act? Who was from the industry, and how did you start to meet these people who were going to help you tour it?
Well, as I said, I already knew these people, like the people that were touring us. I mean, I had been working with those guys for about 6 years already through, you know, doing tours with Jamoan and people like that. So we were in a good position there. And when it was still, when we were touring around Australia, we were still doing anywhere from 50 to 250 people, you know, and primarily playing some pubs, maybe the odd theatre here and there. Then we went to Edinburgh and we were playing 150-seater at the Pleasance, but that just went gangbusters straight away. And we were expecting to go back to Australia straight after that, but we got lured straight onto the West End where we were doing 1,000-seat theatre, 8 shows a week, and we never sort of looked back from there.
Well, can we put a year on that? So when did you go to Edinburgh? 2000.
2000.
Okay, so you've been doing the show for, what's that, 10 years? 11 years?
No, two.
So I thought you said
really only properly one, because we did it in 98.
Oh, that's right.
And then I had a year off.
Right, okay. We didn't do 99 at all.
Yeah. Right, okay.
Maybe so, two shows right at the end.
And then we did a few shows around Australia just to raise some money to take ourselves to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And yeah, then we launched in Edinburgh in 2000.
And what made you want to, because, I mean, in the nicest way possible, 150 seats in Edinburgh is a hard sell for a lot of acts, because it's the biggest arts festival in the world. So what made you want to go with such a big
room? We actually thought that we could have got closed down on the first day, because, you know, Mary Whitehouse situation was still very high back then.
Okay.
So we were expecting that we could get our publicity from being banned or being ashamed or something like that. But there was like 4 or 5 shows that involved nudity and penises.
Yeah. And I'd been to Edinburgh a couple of times before. I'd gone along with Jamoan when he first was having a crack at it. In fact, I'd been twice with him. So I knew the importance. I knew what a wonderful marketplace it was. And, you know, the greatest marketplace in the world for a bit of foolish behaviour like we were looking at doing. So I knew if, you know, this was the one-stop shop for us.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And so it went literally to the West End, or was there like a gap between that time?
Literally to the West End.
Did you get
September, like we opened in the middle of September.
Did you get nominated that year then?
No.
Because normally that's what happens, you get nominated and then you get the West End.
Yeah, right? We didn't get nominated at all. No.
We did extra shows.
Yeah, yeah.
But we never got nominated.
We were certainly one of the hits of the festival, and most of our run was sold out in the first, you know, week and a half.
Mm.
So, we rarely win awards. I think when we're on the West End, the Guardian voted us the best new show on the West End. But that's about all we've ever won.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, because
we're not really interested in the awards. We'll take the crowds and the money.
Exactly. Well, it's kind of odd because, you know, awards are perceived as things that help you sell stuff.
Right.
But in reality, they're sort of a byproduct of having a show that you know, selling.
You know, you look at guys like Phil Nichol and Brendan Burns, who both won the Perry Award.
Oh, yeah.
And it really, it didn't make much difference to them at all, you know.
Yeah.
Phil probably could have won it three or four times
now. Oh, yeah, he's amazing.
Know, he's amazing.
Yeah.
But,
both of them are, yeah.
You know, it really, it doesn't mean so much anymore, I don't think.
No, but I thought it would have done in 2000.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think Garth Marenghi won that year, and poor Garth was, he was next door to us while we were on. We were on at the same time at the Pleasant.
Oh, he was underneath.
And at the end of his show, it was the big reveal for his murder mystery. Mm. And of course, the end of our show is just squealing and screaming and stomping. People stomping their feet.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that he even got through a single show because we should have ruined every one of it. But yeah, he won the award that year.
Yeah, with Richard Ayoub.
Are you Artie?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
He was in that show as well, and Alice as well.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so it's 2000. You're in the West End. How long did that run for? Do you remember?
It was going to be 6 weeks, and we ended up doing just under 6 months.
6 months. Okay. And what's happening behind the scenes at that point? Are you having discussions about touring at other places? Are you thinking about Edinburgh again? Where's your mind at this point? How are you capitalising on that intention?
See, we'd taken on, we were picked up for that by a guy called David Johnson, who was a producer, and he took us to the West End. And then he started managing us as well. Mm-hmm. We very quickly got signed up to do, well, after the West End, we went back to Australia for the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and we went back to a big 1,000-seat theatre, and it was sold out like crazy.
Oh, wow.
The festival goes for a month, but our show ended up running for about 4.5 months there. So what we realised very quickly, what we could do is train up another company.
Yeah.
And franchise. So that's what we did. We held auditions while we were there and we trained up another company. So we finished the month-long comedy festival and then put in this other team to keep the show running while we went and did a tour of the UK, which was, you know, gangbusters. Well, we were doing big 2,000-seaters and doing it to two shows a night. And
during that time, they were preparing to go to Montreal as well. Yeah,
so that comes after that. Yeah.
Yeah.
While we're in this sort of time frame, you've gone from a 50 or like above pub, maybe 50 seater, to 150 for a month, which you know equates to a few thousand.
Yeah,
yeah.
To 1,000 seaters.
Yes.
Yeah. How are you having to evolve the show to accommodate that? I mean, I know now you have like projectors and things, but
always had the projector. The projector was
even in the 50 seater.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Simon. Simon, when I did the show, when I had the mask on, Simon was at the bar and couldn't see what I was doing, but knew that I was doing dick tricks.
Right.
So that's where Simon went, we just used to hang a sheet up and project onto the sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed everything because the people at the back could see.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Didn't have to just be the people in front of you.
Mm-hmm. And the shock factors, I mean, everyone, sure, there's one thing, a guy pulling his dick out, but to have it projected three stories high on a screen right in front of you, that's another thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but then when we went to the West End, we started working with a pianist on stage.
Okay.
Right. So
everything was elevated.
And there was lighting.
Yeah.
And there was sound.
We got proper capes made.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to actually write a script down. Yeah. So all that ad-libbing and all that loose, just working off a list became an actual script where there was cue lines and lighting cues and all that sort of stuff.
We'd like to say that you really can't polish a turd, but you can roll it in glitter. And that's, I think, what we did. We just gave ourselves a good roll in glitter. And
it was completely coated in glitter.
Okay. And because I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of people who, especially after Edinburgh, if they get a big burst of success, the show has to change with what's happening,
right?
And also your audience is going to change there because you're going from hometowns and where you are and like sort of the place where you've always been to even though you've been there before, effectively the other side of the world, where, as you say, sensibilities are different. The British sort of inability to maybe be okay with a penis as much as Australians, and then moving it to London, where in particular that's more of a thing. So were there any other elements that you had to maybe drop or change, or was it like you were just, we're sticking to what we're doing because it anyway?
I think people really enjoyed the Australian side, you know, the Australian aspect of our show.
Right.
So they were more than happy on our first runs. And no one, when we came into the town for the first time, no one's ready for what we're doing. You know, it is very confronting and it's very full on. It's like nothing they've ever seen before. Still to this day, we can go somewhere where we haven't been before and, you know, just people shake their heads and just wonder what the hell's going on. So, we didn't have to do much. We localize it a little bit, like we will try and do local landmarks and localize our material a little bit. But pretty much people loved the Australian larrikin side of what we were doing.
The essence remained exactly the same from the small theatre to the large theatre. The essence is exactly the same. That's what sold the tickets.
The right. One word that kept popping up in reviews was charming. You know, even though it was confronting and horrific and, you know, hilarious, it was still charming.
We were comfortable with our nudity. After a few minutes, it could be, you know, it could be an elbow, it could be any part. It was, disarming.
Yeah. Did you ever feel like, because you're not clothed, is there any sort of routine or regimented, or do you like watch your diet? Like, was there any part of you that felt like, you know, we're now standing in front of 1,000 people a night?
I think our diet during the West End.
Like that pressure, especially at the West End?
Not really.
Our West End diet was three ducks a week, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Three roast ducks from Chinatown.
Wow, okay.
No, we pretty much, I mean, the whole essence of what we were doing is, you know, we have no skeletons in the closet. We are completely naked. You're laughing at our genitals. We have nothing more to give you.
And so there
was absolutely no buff. Shame whatsoever.
Yeah.
And as soon as you started to think about that and started, you know, covering little bits and pieces up and trying to, as soon as any vanity was to creep in, we would have lost the essence of what we were doing.
No, totally. But I could see why it might have even entered your mind for a second when, you know, you're in the West, you know, like everyone's, or a lot of people's big goal is to be a West End star or be on the West End.
It wasn't our goal. We just sort of slipped into it.
Yeah.
We didn't realize what we were doing until it was, you know, we were right in the middle of it.
That's the amazing part of this for me is like the fact that, you know, it's sort of, the more I talk to people about their careers and what they're doing, the more you realize, especially from the industry side, the more you realize they've not, like the ones that are doing well haven't really got a plan. Like the ones that are doing well, they sort of just want to do the show that they're doing.
Yeah.
And that feels very much like what you're doing.
Yeah. Right.
Is that fair?
We're
still doing it.
And I mean that in a nice way that you haven't got a plan. I'm not saying that to discredit at all.
No. And I mean, but every territory we moved into was a brand new thing. No one had taken a show like this in there before. So it wasn't just new for us. It was new for the producers. It was new for the audience. This was, it was a brave new world everywhere we turned.
So the one thing that did change after we came back to Australia in 2001 was that we cloned the company.
Yeah.
So we cloned the show, and once that was up and running, then that gave us the opportunity to think, well, we can do that in this country, in that country. We did it in French, we did it in Spanish, we did it in Argentina, we did it in Mexico.
That's the beauty of this, is that because it is mainly visual, it's a bit like I was talking to Sam Wills in Take Face about this, and he's doing a similar thing at the moment where he's like cloning himself essentially that he can do it in more places.
Yeah.
And I always find that sort of interesting because, like you said, I've seen the originals.
Yeah.
So does anyone ever sort of get a bit, not annoyed, but like, I really want to see the original?
People don't have a clue. Like what because we have our DVD that we sell at the shows, and we have, we've had 60 people that we've trained up over the years, and they go out and they'll sell that DVD, and they've told us in times before that they've gone, who were these guys?
Yeah.
We thought it was you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So they don't really know. And it's like if you go to any West End show, you don't know you're getting the swing actor if someone's having the day off necessarily. Mm. You know what I mean? Unless it's a really famous person.
Yes.
It's just whoever's doing the show.
I guess, and again, I mean this not to do a disservice, you're not necessarily the famous element in a way that other people might be.
No.
Because you are, it's essentially your genitals that are the main focal point, you.
Look, I mean, well, I can do a show in front of 1,000 people and afterwards walk into the foyer and most people still don't recognise you.
That's what I was going to ask,
And I mean, but as I said, I've got a lot of good friends who are sort of in the rock business or in the comedy business who have high profiles, and you know, they find it hard going out and they get hassled a lot. We don't get any, excuse me, we don't get any of the bad trappings, only the good trappings.
And pause. We're in the middle bit. Well, I hope you're enjoying this podcast. I am adoring hearing about how having no plan but very stretchy balls and a lot of drive has built them a career. I also loved hearing their thoughts on political correctness and how they couldn't start now. It's really interesting to hear people be so honest and open about that sort of thing and how the climate in comedy and the zeitgeist has shifted and changed and how they are adapting and adjusting to that. I need to eat, so here comes your mid-roll advert.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Did you get an advert? If you didn't, well, first of all, sorry about the weird pause in the middle. If you didn't get an advert, that means that there is no money coming my way for this episode. If you did get an advert, it means I got 0.2p for this podcast. I'm currently stuck indoors and I have no other means of income. So if you are enjoying this and you have a job, like a day job that is bringing you in money, I would really appreciate some donations. You can do that as a one-off on PayPal or you can become a Patreon from $1 an episode. Is this worth 80p? I think it is. I actually think it's worth a lot more than that, but equally, I am only asking you for whatever you can afford. In the second part of this podcast, we'll be looking at their relationship with social media. We'll also be looking into the future of the show and a potential Netflix deal, as well as the advice that they would give their past selves. Let's dive back in.
So, I was going to ask, like, is it ever frustrating that you're not better known then?
Oh, no, I would much prefer it that way. Yeah.
Yep. We do know people who can't go out. You know, it's not a lonely existence by any stretch, but it's, you know.
It's annoying.
It's annoying that you can't go down to the shop and not get hassled.
Your time's not your own.
That's right.
It's sort of
you're owned by the public.
Yeah. And have you done anything else that has engineered that? Like, have you done any decisions specifically to make sure that you're not as well-known as you could have been?
I always wore a hat and glasses on stage.
Right.
And I used to always joke, well, when... That started because I worked for Norwich Investments.
Right.
All right. So I was working.
You wore that at Norwich Investments and it was.
Yeah. So that then went on to, I don't want my mum, you know, I don't want people taking photos of it. I don't want my mum to see me in the. So I had this disguise. Mm. And that just became part of the act after a while. But I never really worried about the anonymity of it. But it meant that I could walk out into the crowd even more easily because I could walk out without a hat on and no one would even know who I was.
It's just something I'd never really thought about because it was never such an issue. But for me, it was always about half of the joke and half of the appeal and the bravery of it all was just not caring and pretty much saying, this is me, this is everything, take it or leave it. So... it's never really been an issue, to be honest. We're lucky in that respect.
Yeah, all the best comedians, I think, care about the audience, but they also don't care because they sort of have to have that detachment.
It'll do your head in if you care too much.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have a life elsewhere. You know, I mean, I've got friends who literally can't go to the supermarket, and they won't because they get anxiety and whatever, and they always do get hassled. But, you know, that's he can't write material about going to the supermarket anymore, you know. It's like he's losing a big chunk of his life, and for me that would be terrible.
No, definitely. So we're at what year are we at with cloning the company?
That's 2001. And then probably the next up to 2005 roughly, we reopened in France, and we did it in, as I said before, in Argentina and Mexico. We had two companies running in the US, I think. At one point there was three, I think.
Well, there was one Saturday night where we had seven companies running around the world.
Yeah. So how are you, in different languages.
So how are you picking where they're going?
Like, they choose us.
So they come to you and say, we'd love to learn this and take it to our country.
Yeah, look, basically, if it's somewhere like Argentina, Mexico, Spain or France, where it has to be done in a foreign language, we license the show out. We'll go over, audition for them, train them up, and then they pretty much do the show. But if it's like somewhere like Canada or America, we would co-produce it ourselves.
Right. So it's like a franchise.
Absolutely.
So what we used to do as the publicity is that we would run auditions in each place that we did a show of any length, even if it was just 1 week. We would always promote an audition session, and people would turn up. And we were doing it mostly for publicity, but every now and again there would be someone to just go, oh, we've got to keep that guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, definitely. And I'm wondering whether, so is it a case of you charge a license fee per show, or is it a case of the venue will give you a cut of the ticket sales? How do you operate like that?
It depends. It depends on the producer. Like, you know, say the Italians are classically known for not paying any royalties. So you'll make sure that you get a decent chunk of the front end.
Up front.
Whereas, you know, there might be a more reputable partner and you can see some profits being paid on the back end. So you'll take a bigger chunk of the back end. It all depends on who you're dealing with.
Do you have a preference?
No, not really, because, you know, I mean, there are times where we sign license agreements knowing there is no way we're going to get any back end from them, even though it's in the contract.
Right.
So we just are happy to take that big chunk at the front.
Right, okay. So at the moment, how many have you got licensed around the world?
It's not so much at the moment. We've got a show running in Vegas that we produce ourselves. And then there's going to be some shows in the UK this year. There's some stuff in Berlin happening and the show running here. But Friendly and I, we decided to just pull it back. And we started enjoying doing the show again ourselves. So this is the first time we've been doing the show together for about a decade.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I reckon our last shows I did were about 2008 or maybe 2009.
Right.
When my son started going to school, basically.
Right.
Because he was on tour with us the whole time.
And was that a sort of you don't want him seeing the show decision?
Oh, no.
No?
No, just that he's... When we got him to school, it was like, it's no good to tour with them.
Oh, I get you. Okay.
And I didn't... like. We started doing just weekends, so we'd do bigger shows on the weekends, and if I had done that, I would be going on a Friday afternoon, coming home on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah,
he'd be back at school on Monday, so it would be the only time that I would see him would be the small period after school.
Right.
You know, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be there all the time.
That makes sense. Yeah. So we're at 2001. You're cloning companies at this point. And you're sort of sending them off to do the show.
Mm-hmm.
You're still doing the show at this point.
Yeah, so Simon and I, basically, we split and we got a partner.
A separate partner.
One of the other guys. So, yeah, so there was an original, like Simon did Chicago and Boston and all these other places, and I was in Europe at some points. And
well, let's back up a little bit, because in 2001, we did our tour of the UK, and then we went to the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, which is... it's the Edinburgh of Europe, you know. It's the greatest marketplace for North America. So we went in there, and most people get to do a 10-15 minute spot as part of a compilation show, whereas we got to do our entire show.
Oh wow!
In a beautiful little theatre, and
place des Arts.
We did the 3 weeks of the festival, and then we ran on and also did the French festival, and so we made a conscious effort to learn some of our show in French, and that was the first time that we transgressed language barriers, and we thought, okay, this can work in other parts of the world. So But that was also, and then from there we went to Toronto, which was the traditional stepping stone to go into New York. You either go Toronto or Chicago,
right?
And that's how you move into New York. If you have to make a success of one of those.
Okay, so it's like your show has to prove itself in because I always thought it was Boston was a good one for getting into New York because a lot of comics.
That's another stepping stone.
Is that another one? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but we went for Toronto, and I mean, we did extremely well in Toronto,
right.
And our New York season was all set up. We'd gone in there, we'd done a press junket. Mm-hmm. We pretty much came back to, and we were getting ready to get out of Toronto, but we thought the show's still going so well, so we started doing auditions to train up some boys to keep the show going there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on Breakfast Radio doing some live auditions, and it was going really well, and there was a big plasma screen up there in the studio. And I remember just something catching my eye and just seeing this plane hanging out of a tower or going into a tower. And then that was 9/11.
9/11.
We were meant to open.
And it was 2 weeks to the day before we went to New York.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we were due to open on, you know, we were going to open 4 days after 9/11, which is not the best time to open a penis show or any show.
No.
And so we were in real turmoil there. Do we cancel the show? Do we move forward? We had to, you know, the best advice we got was from just people out of bars. Just, you know, do you think it would be inappropriate? And they're going, look, if ever we need a laugh, it's right about now. So we were one of the only shows to survive on Broadway and off Broadway, survive that 9/11 experience.
Yeah. Mm.
And we ended up running on 42nd Street for about nearly 2 years.
That seems to be, and it was also a sensibility when I came over here. So the American sensibility around 9/11 was, we don't want the terrorists to win, just carry on as normal.
Yeah.
And over here, when there were the bushfires early on in the year, I was really torn as to whether I should even come and do my show here.
Right.
Because it felt like, is it disrespectful to be promoting a comedy show? When
not at all.
No, yeah. But every Australian I spoke to was like, no, bring it over. Like,
yeah.
If you've already booked it in, like, if you're booking it in now, see, maybe a bit, you know.
The koalas weren't going to buy tickets anyway.
Yeah.
You're okay.
Yeah, but I can understand that turmoil that you're sort of like, and I'm not even undressed, so I can understand that you maybe like felt a bit more like, is this going to be disrespectful? Is this going to cause?
Well, it was either that or I decided to feel more like Bob Hope slinging the golf clubs over the shoulders and, you know, going into the war zone. That's the way we we took to it, and
there were a lot of there's a lot of people that people in the street, you know, when they heard her accent would just say thank you for being there.
Yeah,
you know, that sort of stuff. It was really interesting.
Definitely.
Because New York is a notorious for not speaking to
people. Yeah, right? Hard nuts.
So people, I can just remember quite a number of times people coming up to us and saying, why are you here? Thanks for being here. And, you know,
immigration officer.
But it was a very interesting time to be in New York, that's for sure.
Definitely. So how often are you doing a show at this point? Is it every night?
Except Mondays.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm wondering whether there's a
two
limit
shows,
to how
two
many
shows on the weekend usually too.
Oh, like a matinee and a
seven and say seven.
Seven
and
nine.
Yeah. So is there a limit to how often you can do this show physically?
I didn't want to do it anymore. Like the West End was the first time that we'd really like done eight shows. Like it was the first time we'd really done two shows a day, continually. I think we maybe did two shows in one day in Edinburgh,
right?
Where we did an extra show in the theatre, like one day.
You've got to learn to back off and just, you know, be a little more careful with your stuff, with your package.
Yeah. With your props, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It also became interesting because we would, I remember clearly, like, being on stage and going, oh, hang on, I've already done this bit. And it was like, did I do it in the earlier show or am I doing it in the next show? Shit, what bit am I up to? It was like,
yeah, you have to.
Because you go into this, like, you know what, you just go into the zone and you can, all of a sudden it's like, oh, how long, I've said that today.
Yeah. No, it's a weird chart because also, like, I don't know if you, because I also go through some stuff if, like, I felt like it didn't go well the last time or even if I felt like I stumbled over my words. So I would have done it in the morning, in an afternoon show and then a bonus show.
Right.
Yeah. And by the bonus show, you're, especially if, like, or like if you're doing, I don't know if you do this, but like if I do like short club spots or whatever, by the time I get to the third one, about 10 minutes into it, I'm like,
What am I up to?
Yeah, and then they can feel that. They're like, oh, he's losing confidence. You're like, I'm not losing confidence, I'm losing my place.
That's right.
A massive difference, yeah.
Well, it's lucky, but because we have, our structure is, you know what's coming after the next trick, and we sort of have broken these tricks down into sections, and they naturally follow each other. So, you know, we've got that structure to fall back on.
Completely, completely. So, okay, so we're in 2002, I think you said.
Yep.
Right, you're doing New York.
Yep.
And where's next? What's been your plan next, and what's actually come up?
Well, after New York, we got another team in New York to keep that going, and then we moved to LA.
Okay, so you trained someone up while you were there?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, okay.
We were constantly training people.
Yeah.
Constantly.
It's like Fight Club. You're constantly getting your franchises
Wherever we went, we did the auditions.
Right.
And we got, as we said, we had... I think by the end of 2004, we'd already had 40 people on stage by that stage.
Right.
You know, 4 years after we'd actually been to Edinburgh, we'd had that many people on stage.
So after New York, we decided that we wanted to conquer LA, the other coast, right. And from there you would start moving your way around. That was, you know, usually how it was done. Mm-hmm. So we had a season at the Coronet Theatre, which is now Largo. Lovely little 300-seat theatre right in the middle there in Hollywood. And then luckily on, I think, our opening night, we have an audience participation section of the show where we get someone up to do a thing called the fruit bat, where, you know, I would do a handstand and you get them to hold your ankles up in the air. It's hilarious. But this woman that we invited up, it was her birthday, she was also the talent booker on The Tonight Show. Okay. And so next thing you know, we found ourselves booked on The Tonight Show.
Right.
Which was huge. Our friend and I had already set up some more boys in LA. Mm. So we had a team in New York, a team in LA, and friend and I went to San Francisco to conquer that. And we were due to go on the Tonight Show about a week and a half later. While we're up there in San Francisco, we went on Cron TV.
Can I check? Was that your first American primetime TV spot then?
We'd done bits and pieces, stuff. But The Tonight Show was, that's it.
That's pretty big.
That was, yeah, yeah. I'm just wondering what else had built you up at that point. Maybe, you know, because if it's your first and you've not done any others, that's a big start.
We'd done Howard Stern in New York. Okay. We'd done a couple of regional things. We'd done a couple of these daytime shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this was the, you know.
They were your tipping
This was
point.
The one.
Big league.
Yeah.
They tipped you over the edge, kind
Absolutely.
Of.
Absolutely.
Okay, right.
And so then we were doing this Cron TV breakfast show, and there was two female hosts. We were there in our capes having a bit of a chat, and then halfway through they said, listen, we still don't really know what you're doing. We blocked it out with them. We're going to stand up. We're going to open our capes. We'll do a few tricks. You just show their reactions, the hostess's reactions, and shoot us from the waist up, Elvis style. Mm. Now, the cameraman or the director has completely messed up. We were unaware of this, but Friendy's Eiffel Tower has gone right across Greater California Breakfast at 8:30 in the morning. We were escorted and from the TV station. We had no idea.
We had no idea what was going on. They just went, right, you're just like, everything went black. It's like, oh, what's happened?
And then as soon as we got in the car, our publicist started getting phone calls, and we realized what had happened. The station had gone to black, and this was a...
Gone out.
It was a big...
Breakfast.
It was a big thing.
No, it was a penis at breakfast.
And then, you know, the NBC executives started telling Jay Leno, well, listen... Because the TV station blamed us. They said we did it as a PR stunt. We're saying, that's not true. We don't need to do that. And Leno was told that he couldn't have us on. So, to his credit, he said, no way. These guys are fine. Got us back in for another chat. Made sure that we were going to, you know, we weren't going to do something similar again. And had us on. And for the night that we were on, for the first time in the history of The Tonight Show, Salt Lake City, their affiliate there, refused to take The Tonight Show for one night only. Because we were on, and that didn't happen back through any of the, you know, Rolling Stones or anything like that. It was amazing. So we've got that to be thankful for.
Yeah, because I imagine censoring you actually helps in a weird way.
The press that we got out of that was amazing. But once again, appearing on The Tonight Show, and we got 3 nights of blanket coverage, because the night before we were on, Jay Leno was talking about us. The night we were on, and then the night after we were on, he was talking about us.
Yeah.
So this was huge.
Arsenio Hall came to the actual show and was interviewed in the foyer and interviewed people. It went for ages. It was fantastic.
But then
But then after that, you would expect, okay, well, this is huge for them. But then the Bush government changed the laws, the decency laws in broadcasting. And it went from a $30,000 fine for indecency to over $300,000 for the producer, for the performer, and for the broadcaster. So it was nearly $1 million fine all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So whereas all these radio stations and TV stations and even newspapers running our ad, they all had to pretty much shut down. So as we reached our peak in America, we got shut out.
Yeah, it was all around that same time of the Nipplegate as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That was all tied in together. It was that. It was like we were actually mentioned in the court documents.
Yeah. There was two big events. Yeah. There was Nipplegate and Friendly's Balls.
Yeah.
So that's yeah, because it sort of feels like. Because TVs, obviously, they've got the watershed hour and they've got the sort of limitations on what you can do. But it doesn't feel like, and, you know, it's obviously you're not trying, you don't sort of need to do that. Even at the start of the show, you say, you know, we're going to do the reveal to get rid of that shock value because it doesn't ever feel like that's what you're wanting from this. You actually want it to be the tricks, not the shock value of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, half the joke of this has been trying to sell it as art. That's the funny thing for me.
Right.
And so that's what I insist that we keep pushing. You know, we need to be serious about the installations we're creating. And, you know, I mean, and once you do that after 10 minutes, you're pretty much just, you know, you're forgetting that it's a penis and a couple of testicles. It could be someone's elbow, you know.
Yeah, totally.
You get desensitized to it.
Yeah, I was wondering whether you know if you get many repeat. Oh, God, I was trying so hard not to make that make a noise, and then I'm sorry, there was only got some more I can get.
I can't believe you're urinating at the table, Chris.
Friendly. Do you get many repeat viewers? Like, do people come back, or is it like once you've seen it, you've seen it?
What we find is that most people who come back are bringing, as we said earlier, bringing a group of people back. That they want to watch their reactions to the show. It's not like a show that you know, we've got good friends with Arj Bark, and people go and see Arj's show every time he comes out. People don't necessarily do that with us. They'll come to the show, they'll get their shock, and then they want to see what their mum reacts, or their best friend reacts, or sometimes they'll do a hen's night or something like that.
We like to joke that anyone comes more than three times that gets a restraining order. But you know, when we were in Perth recently, there was this gentleman that insisted on sitting in the front row, and he was there for like 6-7 shows in a row. And you know, the venue was saying, you know, do you want us to ban him? And I said, is he paying his $45? Well, then let him come again.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll take his money.
He was harmless. He was just he was obsessed by the show.
It's one of those ones where, again, like I said, it either turns on the people that turns on, it turns off the people that turns off.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that the Gogglebox, I don't know if you have that over here with Gogglebox, where it's now becoming, and I think YouTube's got a lot to answer for that, because there's a lot of like reacting to my old videos and all that sort of looking back on yourself type thing. And I suppose I can never get the shock again of watching you for the first time, but I can get the shock of watching my mum see you for the first time.
Get the joy of watching your mum have the shock.
Yes, exactly. So I can see that completely. Because obviously, if not, you would potentially have run out of viewers by now.
Well, no, because
you'd be amazed what a big world it is out there.
There's a lot of people, and that's
maybe, you know, why we said numbers. I'm reflecting.
When you think there's over 4 million people living in Adelaide now, a tiny, minuscule percentage of those have been to see our show.
That's right.
So yeah, it's a big world out there, and you just got to keep slugging away at it.
Every couple of years, there's a new group of adults coming through that haven't seen the show. You know, we started 20 years ago, and now, you know, our peak of numbers back in the early 2000s and up to, you know, 2010s, that sort of period, that's 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
Those people were 8 years old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
So there's all those people that are still out there that haven't seen it.
Yeah. How long do you think you two can do it for? Like, is there a point where you think, I mean, obviously it comes back to that reflection question from the West End, but is there only a point where you think, actually, I can't do this anymore, or I think at my age, I don't want to do it anymore. Like, is there any of those thoughts that you've had?
I was reluctant to come back. But look, it's been okay. I always worried that, you know, I'd have to be wheeling my ball bag around in a wheelbarrow. I thought, because we stretch it so much, I thought it'd be, you know, knocking around our knees. And I thought that would be the actual reason that we'd have some sort of physical limitation. But, you know, we still seem to be holding together right now.
I mean, you know, the shows are going as well as they ever did have. I mean, luckily there's one part of us that hasn't wrinkled, so. but, you know, I mean, I enjoy the stagecraft of it. I enjoy getting out there. I enjoy the juices flowing and coming up with new material. And, you know, it just gets me in a better headspace, you know, for my life. I live in a very rural situation, so I need a good excuse to get out and about occasionally. So, you know, I think... I mean, I don't know how much longer for, but at the moment we're enjoying it. And, you know, I'm happy to do another year or two. But then at that some point, I think we're going to have to, you know, think about, someone else doing it.
Hanging up the cape.
Yeah.
I also read that you had a one-off special in 2012, TV special, like you did the whole show. Was that right?
No. Not a TV special.
In 2000, we... Well, 2001, we recorded our live show.
Yeah, we have a live DVD, but I think it might have been broadcast here on Australian TV, but I'm not sure.
Oh, maybe that's
the the documentary of us, because we
Tackle
filmed
Happy, that
Tackle
one?
Happy. Yeah, that okay. That was 98. That was the very first tour. We filmed the whole thing, and that's been on UK TV, and it's been on Australian TV, but not for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, ignore that bit then. There
was an HBO special that they recorded in about 2001 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes gets a rerun, I've heard. And
not here, though.
Yeah, not here. But, you know, every now and again you'll get someone saying, oh, I saw your thing on TV the other day on some obscure channel. But, yeah, I don't think there's been anything recently.
No, okay. I only wanted to know whether... you'd ever pitched for something like Netflix or Amazon Prime, and whether you think, you know, that would be an appropriate platform for...
Well, we're doing that at the moment.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then Netflix is just starting up in Australia, and we're hoping that they're going to be subjected to local content laws, which means they have to have a percentage of local product.
All of them. So, all those overseas companies.
That's what we're ready and poised to jump on.
Are you allowed? Can we talk about that?
You can. I mean, you know, I'm working with a production company that is, and you know, we've come up with an idea where it will be basically stories that led me up to doing Puppetry of the Penis, and it would be mixed with stories from the road, a little before and after, jumping around with timelines. So we're sort of developing that at the moment and working on characters.
A bit like your Jerry before Seinfeld, if you've seen that.
Yeah, sort of similar to that, you know, but with sort of splashes of, you know, have you seen Get Shorty?
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
so
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's sort of like a dark comedy drama.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was wondering whether, because obviously, I only wondered whether, given that your social media stuff is getting limited because of the nature of it, whether Netflix or whether Amazon Prime or any of those demand players would be more the area you could get the word out.
Well, we're trying. We're trying. Yeah. I mean, I've been trying to get a film script off the ground for 10 years. We've never done the drama thing, but that's what we're developing now. And, you know, hopefully I'll have some good news for you in about 3 or 4 months.
Well, I'll get you back on about then. What other things do you... I mean, do you ever feel restricted by the act? Do you ever feel like you're tied into it and you can't go off and do solo stuff? Like, is there any
not at all
drawbacks?
No, we've both got our, you know, separate lives. I mean, I've got a couple of other projects that I'm working on at the moment.
I did a TV show a few years ago. It's 10 years ago now. And that didn't interfere. Like, wasn't really mentioned.
So were your original fears about your face, like, I mean, obviously with a day job it might have been founded, but in terms of your brother, for example, saying it might ruin his career, do you think those fears are actually quite unfounded?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I did mine as a bit of, as a joke as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, when I was working at Norwich, that wasn't a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't long, but I reckon I did one show And then I got retrenched from Norwich, so it didn't last long anyway, so it didn't really matter.
Because when I was thinking about this pod, I was thinking, if you, I know you said you probably couldn't start it now, but if you had started now, there probably would be like camera phone footage of your first gig that would have gone out.
Absolutely.
So you maybe wouldn't have got the freedom to develop it undercover.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether you've ever thought about that.
Well, when we first recorded our live DVD, it was like I was really strict on trying to not let it get out on the internet because my thought was, well, you know, if people see the actual show, then they won't go to the show.
And is that found? Because
no, well, I mean, you don't know. But I think some people would be like that.
Mm.
But I mean, think about Nanette. A lot of people have seen Nanette, but they still go and watch Nanette.
It's
a show. I mean,
I'm just curious as to whether it does have an. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, I think it was Bill Burr was talking about it on a podcast recently where he said, you know, I would go to it was someone like that who said, I went to a town and told them, you know, I gave them DVDs to put online to say, next time I'm back, you know, here's the sort of thing I do. And that sort of helped build their base in little cities beyond the one show they could do.
Yeah.
And so, and being that your act has come up through no internet, no social media, and now has both. Whether these sort of things have ever, you know, you've ever reflected about how you maybe would have marketed it differently, how you would have dealt, how maybe you would have used social media earlier on, maybe. I don't know whether it...
I think we would have been even more banned.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because we didn't have any profile. If we had no profile, we would have been really, really shut down. Like, where, because we've actually got, we do have a profile, millions of people have seen the show. That's the only.
We're now in a situation where people are coming to the show saying, "Oh, my mum and dad saw you 20 years ago." You know, they're actually getting recommendations from their parents.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what we're in. The whole social media thing. I mean, it's a plus for us in some ways, but it's also a huge hindrance.
Yeah.
I must say, I do miss the idea, the old days where you can rock into a town, spend $3,000 and get a quarter page ad in the local rag and everyone knows you're there.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, we don't have any of these options anymore. No. We can't advertise on social media. No one reads the local rags. It's a problem.
No, completely. Are there any places you find that it doesn't sell?
It all depends. I mean, when I'm touring around the UK, there's local, you know, you're very much at the beck and call of your local theatre. It depends on how much they're going to push it to their local community. Some of them don't even put your posters up in the foyer and they'll back off and you'll end up with just 200 people.
You can really notice it when they haven't put the posters up.
But those that really get behind it and they tweet it out and they use their Facebook page, you know, to the full advantage, well, then you can end up with 800 people. So it's we really, I mean, this is a dangerous thing, but you really are at the beck and call of the theatre managements now.
Mm. So you don't have... maybe a mailing list that's specific to city to make it easier for you to advertise and not have to be on there.
Not really. I mean, we've got people on, you know, people that like our page. We've got like, you know, 25,000-30,000 people on, you know, Facebook and stuff like that.
Mm.
But they're scattered from all over the world, and you know, we can't target them, we can't boost them. But you know, we can post stuff.
And it goes back to that single use type of thing as well, where, you know, let's say 1,000 people come to the show, 100 of those people might come back and go again.
Yeah.
So if we've got a mailing list, it sort of doesn't really translate to numbers.
No, I get that. And when you're deciding what to do next, I mean, we're talking like live now, not necessarily online. What's your aim for the show? How did you pick Adelaide? What goes through your mind when you're saying, should we go here?
Well, for me, it was, I've been living in the UK, so to get out of England this time of year is an absolute blessing.
Agreed.
But I wanted, you know, because Friendy and I hadn't done the show for a while together, I thought doing a festival environment where we can do it every night and get our, you know, our chops back up. So that was the plan behind doing this. And, you know, then in a comfortable way, I just wanted to do one more lap of Australia.
And, you know, sort of a farewell tour, another one. And I was hoping to get my kids out later in the year, early next year, and, you know, they can, as I'm going down the coast, they can come and see a bit of, you know, the great brown land.
Mm.
That's the rough plan, but we're just sort of, at the moment, we're just sort of, you know, taking it easy. We're doing it in a very gentle, you know, relaxed manner.
Definitely. What drives you at the moment then? What's your driving force?
For me, I'm still trying to push to make the show the best it can possibly be. And I'm using, you know, I like having my flying hours up so I can use these creative juices to push other projects that I want to do, which, you know, be it pitching to Amazon or Netflix or something like that. It helps being active in the show and active in the moment to, you know, to conjuring up these stories and making it work.
I just get told what to do.
Just turn up and get your dick out.
Usually by my wife, but at the moment it's Simon.
Yes. Friendly and I are both in a situation now where it's we can actually get our wives saying, go get your husband, go get your cock out, husband.
Yeah. What do you, are you friends beyond the show then?
You know, we met through making shapes out of our genitals.
Mm.
That's been the basis of what we do over the years. And, you know, Friendy and I always like to think that we're a couple of guys that wouldn't necessarily have been, you know, best buddies unless we hadn't gone to war together and ended up in the trenches together. What we went through, no one else has gone through something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're bonded by a very unique experience, and, you know, it's a big chunk of time as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what do you think's the sort of your secret, at least, to the longevity of a double act?
You need your own time.
Yeah, you've got to have your own space, because when you are literally, I mean, Friendy and I were, you know, what started out as like, let's take the show to Edinburgh for a month, ended up being about 5 years literally living together day and night. And so, you know, in any, I mean, I think Martin Lewis, who was it? Alexei Sayle said this. He said, in every great comedy duo, you've got one person that will go out and, you know, spend way too much time with the ladies and take all the drugs and drink way too much and wake up with a hangover and do it all again. And there'll be someone else that'll go home and diligently write and construct the material. And, you know, you look at Martin Lewis and Abbott and Costello, that was the case. And what did he say? He said, that's why Hale and Pace is such a shit show, because they're both going out. And I think that was Friendy and I in many respects. We both went out and gave it a good old-fashioned caning. But we were lucky enough that our product was unique enough and strong enough that, you know, we could do it in a very blurry way.
And the looseness was part of the charm.
Yeah.
Mm, I can see that. Were there any opportunities that you had to turn down along the way by being in this show that you regret turning down?
Not really. I mean, we were flying high and living such a wonderful life. I mean, every man traveling the world, getting his cock out for an hour a night and getting paid rather well. And that's what we were doing.
I missed out on being a computer programmer. Like, COBOL was, you know, the year 2000 problem. That's like...
you could have solved the Millennium Bug, you know?
You were still punching cards when they were computer programming.
Yeah. No, year 2000 was my language. Months. I've actually got a degree in computing, that's why.
Computer science?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they used to punch cards.
Yeah. Yeah, mine was 2009.
Yeah. I graduated in 1994.
Oh, okay.
The year before Windows came out.
Oh, wow. I feel like your degree was slightly different to mine.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was all first-gen languages.
Oh, yeah. Were there any things that you said yes to that you now regret saying yes to?
I can't say I have any regrets. You know, we've made bad decisions, but things, you know, they're things you learn from.
Mm.
But you can't live your life with regrets. I mean, you know, we've been in situations where people have ripped us off and, you know, but we've signed things we probably shouldn't have signed, but you live and you learn, and you can't torture yourself over that. You've just got to move on. It's not going to do your head any good.
Mm. Well, last quick fire questions.
Yep.
Okay, here we go. So, what's one unpopular opinion you have about the comedy industry?
Reviewers. I think they should be... They should be reviewing... They should be telling, you know, the reader, how the people in the theatre enjoyed it. I mean, I've been in rooms where,
yeah,
you know, I've seen people side-splitting, laughing and crazy, and then you get some hacked-out performer who, you know, could never quite cut it and is now reviewing shows, and they start dissecting their material when they should be just saying, look, people really had a great time. I mean, A.A. Gill...
A.A. Gill, I was going to say,
he did a wonderful hatchet job on us for Sunday Times, and it was a two-page hatchet job just saying, you know, I think his opening line was, what was the ugly, wrinkly piece of skin attached to the end of the penis? Well, in Pupture the Penis's case, it's Simon Morley and David Friend.
Yeah.
But then, right at the end of the article, he did mention that his wife had the time of her life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, everyone was cacking themselves. And it's like there's so many times where you get that where every single person in the entire theatre was just pissing themselves laughing, except for the reviewer.
Yeah.
Who's trying to intellectualize what you're doing? It's like, oh, fuck off.
I think that there was one we had that was very similar to that. It was like, you know, every single other person seems to be laughing, but I hated it. You know, it was like, I just didn't understand what they were laughing at. It was like,
yeah. Yeah, they reviewed the fucking audience, not your own opinion. Yeah, I get that. So a lot of performers, like comedians, will call themselves comedians, but they might make more money from writing, for example. So so they're the way they identify themselves is different to the way they financially would identify themselves. How would you, like, what would it say on your business card, but what would your bank manager say you actually are?
We're dick trickers.
Yeah.
That's how you define yourself.
And producers.
Performers. Yeah.
Producers.
Yeah, I mean, you know. I mean, I got sick of being asked what my profession was years ago going through airports. I tell everyone I'm a dolphin trainer nowadays.
Helicopter pilot.
Yeah.
I say theatre producer because no one ever asked me to tell them a play.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want to say comedian. Say, tell us a joke.
No.
Fuck off.
No.
I've just been on a long-haul flight, for God's sakes.
Yeah, definitely. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you overcome it?
I think the greatest mistakes can be...
You've never made a mistake.
It can be, the best mate you've ever made.
It can be getting into bed with the wrong people, you know. But, you know, these people for a while serve their purpose, but then things change and, you know, I think my advice would be never, ever sign anything without proper representation and knowing exactly what you're going into. Because when you sign these pieces of paper, it's, you know, that's it. These people own a chunk
of
it.
They hold you to it.
So, it would be... All my regrets are in a legal manner.
Okay.
I shouldn't have ridden away from the police without my bike helmet the other day.
You probably shouldn't have.
Yeah. What are the biggest misconceptions people have about what you do?
I think it's a sex show.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of people think it's very sexual, but, you know, the truth of the matter is there's nothing more unsexual than flaccid male genitalia.
Yeah.
And laughter, you know.
Or laughing at the genitalia.
Yeah. Anyone who can get slightly aroused while, you know, there's hundreds of people laughing at them, they're not for us.
Do you think the bachelorette nights that you do in Vegas have contributed to that? Because
because it's still not sexual.
They could misunderstand. That's what I mean by misunderstanding.
When you say we do bachelorette nights, you occasionally get bachelorette parties coming to our audiences.
Yeah.
So then it's not all bachelorettes.
Oh, okay, fine. Yeah. Sorry.
So they're not specifically bachelorettes.
Yeah. Right, okay, I misunderstood.
We market to them because it's a group of girls coming to the show.
Yeah.
And again, it's like when I did it 15, 20 years ago, it was because those girls don't want the sexy in your face sexual stuff. And the guys with the dicks and
you've just finally made a commitment to the man you've loved, and the last thing you want is, you know, some buffed up guy with shaving cream down a G-string sticking it in your face.
Yeah. No, totally. You know? What's the most interesting thing you do that nobody ever gets to see? Keep it clean. I mean, yeah. We'll be.
I make sausage.
You make real sausage.
I make real
people
sausages.
People get to see that.
People
though.
Get to eat them. No, but not everybody. Well, only a select few.
I make beer and I make cider and all sorts of stuff like that. And
we've got little cottage industries.
Yeah. I make jam. I make a lot of jam and sauce.
All right. Now he's being filthy.
Yeah. Who do you think is the most underrated person in the industry?
Underrated.
Well, you can't say you, just like you.
No.
Phil is underrated.
Phil Nichol would definitely be one of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think Phil's absolutely brilliant. Mm. And, you know, we should be seeing him on all these panel shows, and he should be popping up everywhere. He should be allowed to, you know, write his own TV shows.
He's an absolute gem of a performer. Mm-hmm. He's brilliant, he's clever, he's smart, and he's a hell of a guy.
And he's wonderful, you know, the way he helps out other comedians and younger people coming up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's a mentor. I mean, yep.
He should be a superstar.
Yeah. No, he's always been amazing to me, and I love him to bits. What do you think is the biggest problem in the comedy industry, and how would you go about solving it?
I haven't really been around for a while, so, okay. You know, I've really only just stepped back in. You know, it's really weird because I'm stepping back in now, and all the guys that were up and coming are now selling out big rooms.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the difference in 10 years, so... Mm. I really don't know.
I've got faith that, you know, cream floats.
Yeah.
You know, if you're good enough and you soldier on and you work on your craft, you'll get there.
Mm.
But, you know, a lot of it is choosing your representation wisely, you know. I mean, in Australia, we've got a couple of management outfits. And, you know, if you're with one, you're going to probably get a job on radio here. And if you're with another, you'll get a job there. So work out what you want to do and get in the right camp.
Definitely. What's one thing you wish you were better at?
Sausage making.
Oh no, I'm pretty good at that. I'll be any better at that. And yeah,
you just do that.
Yeah, you'd be a butcher.
Oh god, there's lots of things. You're probably better off asking my wife that question.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the next
cleaning
question.
Cleaning.
yeah, I'm awful at that. Well, the next question was going to be, what's one thing you think you're great at?
Everything. Dinner parties.
Dinner party, okay.
Yeah, I'm a great dinner party guest.
Oh, guest I can nail.
Yeah,
hosting,
yeah.
I fucking hate.
Oh, no, I'm a pretty good host,
too. I can do it.
I'm a bit of a chef, and
it's all sausages.
I've got no shortage of good stories. So.
I'm very good at beer, wine, cider, I'm really good at. I've been making tomato sauce and plum sauce for close on 20 years, and I've pretty much nailed that.
Nice. Yeah. What's the best bit of advice you've ever been given?
If it smells like shit, it usually is shit. And that goes for everything in contracts.
Yep.
In people you're dealing with, in
doesn't matter that it's rolled in glitter, it smells like shit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
for me, I think the best advice would be don't die wondering.
Yeah.
Have a red hot go. Whatever you're going to do, have a proper go at it, and let failure be your best friend. You know, sometimes you don't be scared of failure.
No.
You know, every great show was a shit show for, you know, a good 6 months before it turned into a great show. So you've got to go through that pain barrier. Don't be frightened of that.
Completely. Well, my last question was going to be, if you could go back to any point in your career and give yourself any advice that you have now, when would it be and what would it be? And it feels like that would have been yours, but
there'd
you can give a different answer
if you
want.
There'd be a don't sign it somewhere.
Don't sign
that one.
There's a couple of don't sign them's.
Right.
I just wish I'd been wearing mittens and, you know. I mean, now you don't even sign anything, do you?
No.
Nah. God. Just hit reply on email. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's amazing what that little squiggly line.
There was one that I didn't sign, and the chain reaction after that, we got so much stuff of our own back from not signing one thing because I didn't trust it because to me it smelt like shit.
Yeah, follow your gut instinct.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
That's a pleasure, mate. Thanks for having us.
That was Puppetry of the Penis. I loved hearing about how they've had to work around such negative issues, including being banned from venues and towns, as well as losing their Facebook and Twitter profiles on multiple occasions. I loved hearing about how they're franchising the show and how they're able to essentially train up other people to do it so they can earn money when they sleep, but they can also do multiple shows in different parts of the world. at the same time. I think we'd all love to do that if we could sell them, obviously. There's no fun doing 7 shows in different continents if you're not selling them. But it was just fascinating and really exciting to hear. And it really sort of reflected some of the stuff that I spoke about with Tapeface in my podcast with him, which if you're interested in listening to, I would scroll back and give that a listen. I've been in for so long, gang. Seriously, I'm getting cabin fever. If you are looking for more content, I would recommend the Tapeface episode, but I'd also recommend the one with Jeremy Dyson and Sam Bain, who talked a lot about similar things than the subjects in this podcast. If you've got some money and you'd like to keep this podcast going and you'd like me to not go hungry, I would massively appreciate it. I know I'm laying on the please give me a donation a little thicker than usual, but I'm stuck indoors and it's my only means of income. So if you would like to donate via PayPal, there is a link in the show notes and it's a one-off. If you would like to become a Patreon from $1 per episode, is this worth 80p? I bloody think it is. Check it out. There's a link in the show notes as well. I've also started a new podcast called Simon Kane Quarantined. It's a almost daily, it's quite regular, podcast with a little bit of chatter from me talking about the coronavirus, talking about the news, talking about anything positive I can come up with on the day that kind of tries to stop us from going insane. So if you would like to give that a listen, there's a link in the show notes to that. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. And thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.